Revival.
Welcome to Street Science,
where we discuss science and its effects on your health,
your life,
and the planet.
Neutron, proton, mass defect, lyrical oxidation, your irrelevant mass spectrograph, your electron volt, atomic energy, erupting as I get all open on betatrons, gamma rays, thermal cracking, cyclotron, any and every mic you're on, transit radium, if you're with your radium, the molecules want it.
Hello, and welcome back to Street Science on Planet FM 104.6. As usual, we are here every Wednesday at 6 p.m., and we would like to thank our sponsor, MediRay, for their continued support in funding our little presentation here every week. MediRay is a supplier of science equipment and laboratory products. And again, welcome back to our listeners on Arrow FM. It's awesome to be played on your station, and thank you, and hopefully you find today's topic interesting. So today we have Ben and myself in the studio. Hi, Ben. It's good to see you.
Hey, Blue.
And we are talking about beer today and the science behind making it and the process behind ending up with the awesome beer products we have available to us these days. And to help us do this, we have Kerry Templeton, a real-life brewer, to help us. So hi, Kerry. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, guys.
And so before we jump into Kerry's brewing skills and the beer that he creates, I thought we could just go over a bit of background on the history of beer and some random facts. So when I first started looking, I actually thought wine was older than beer, just because I thought wine was easier to make because it self-ferments, but apparently that's not actually the case. Beer was discovered first. And it's believed to date back to around 10,000 BC or somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 BC. There's a few different evidence between those years, somewhere in Mesopotamia, which is Iraq today. And
apparently it's possible that someone sampled water which had bread sitting in it. And then they were like, well, this tastes kind of nice, and that's how we got beer. Is that how it goes?
Right, yeah. I think that's one of the leading sort of ideas about how it was first stumbled across, because it seems to coincide with the dawn of cereal agriculture, so making bread. So, yeah, right. It could definitely have been the case. And someone must have been pretty hungry, having left their beer to ferment in some water for a while, and then tried it. So it's likely these sort of first brews or these first batches involve sort of crushed or malted grain steeped and then heated slowly in water. The first records in Astoria from the Gilgamesh epic, which was 2,500 to 3,500 BC, by the Sumerians, and it was on clay tablets, a recipe for making beer. So that was one of the...
Wow.
Yeah, so that was pretty interesting. And by 2000 BC, the Sumerians had at least 8 recipes using barley and 8 from wheat.
Right, so it caught on pretty quickly.
Yeah, so popular. I think it got popular pretty quick, yeah.
Yeah, well, there is a theory that agriculture started because humans liked consuming the product of beer.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
Right. That could make sense. Yeah.
I could get behind that.
There is a theory that, you know, the growth of grain, you know, we needed to grow the grain to produce the beer, so...
So beer was the driver for grain agriculture?
For domesticated,
or one of them,
yeah.
That could well be the case. And also, I think with the ancient Egyptians and even during the Middle Ages, it was a lot safer to drink beer than drink water that was available to people, just because of infections and bacterial disease and contaminated water, and the alcohol content of beer actually made it a safer option.
It's a mildly alcoholic solution.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's also been boiled in the production. So, yeah, it generally is a lot safer.
Yeah, sterilized to a point, yeah. So to the extent that even some early churches, the way they managed to even stay open was due to the profits of making beer, and it was like a gift from God type thing was how it was interpreted. And there's a little joke I came across that beer was discovered just before the hangover, which made sense. And it was described as liquid bread, which was quite interesting too. And apparently brewing beer is a combination of both art and science. So it's this culmination of aesthetically pleasing things and the scientific things that we enjoy talking about so much. And this artistic science aspect of it just comes from the four main ingredients, which is pretty much all I knew until earlier this week. And I'm sure Kerry will help us elaborate on that in a minute. So we'll just cut to some music for a little bit, and then we'll come back and chat with Kerry about his brewing.
Don't want young words. Now, baby, I don't want young words. 'Cause I feel like I'm floating while I'm drawing plans for the morning. While you're mourning me 'cause I'm leaving, I'm not feeling free. Not me, 'cause I feel like I'm floating while I'm drawing plans for the morning. While you're mourning me 'cause I'm leaving, I'm not feeling free. Not me.
Okay, welcome back. So if we jump across to you, Kerry, maybe you could just give us a little bit of your history and your scientific research history, and then a bit about how you got into creating your Mythica beer.
Right, so yeah, I come from a science background, molecular biology, genetics background. I've worked in the field of molecular genetics, I guess.
Right, was it Via Lactea, was it?
Oh, yeah,
your previous company?
Via Lactea, which is a subsidiary of Fonterra.
Right.
But previous to that, I'd worked at Hort Research, which is now Plant and Food, and even previous to that, Ag Research.
Right, right. So that's a long history in research.
Yeah, 17 years, I think I worked out the other day. Around, the year 2000, I started actually working in science.
And always molecular biology?
Always molecular biology, and always in plant, 99% of the time in plants.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
And how did you go the shift from... So what plants do you work in now? Is it mainly...
I work on kiwifruit at the moment.
Mainly kiwifruit, right.
I've worked on ryegrass, which is what they feed cows. I've worked on petunia, clover. I think that covers most of what I've worked on as the target species. There's been a bunch of other things in there, like tobacco and Arabidopsis, but the...
Right, right. So quite a good range.
Yeah.
So I was just to get started for any of our listeners that aren't too sure, what can you just describe the basic process of how beer is made?
So it's as simple as it is. It's you're extracting sugars from the grains. You then boil it with the hops, and the hops produce the bitterness, which then you then as you cool it and transfer it to a fermenter, you can add extra hops at this stage to add some aromas to the beer, and then you ferment it with the yeast, which turns the sugars into alcohol and produces a fair bit of CO2 at the same time, and then you basically transfer it to a bottle and drink. This is a very simplistic
description.
I could go into a lot of detail, but we could be here for hours.
So when you first generate the sugars right at the start, that's the malting process, is that right?
So the malting process is actually the malting of the grain. So the grain you buy is already malted, so you buy malted barley.
Which is essentially sprouted.
They just sprout it and then they dry it out. I'm not 100% certain of the process, but they dry it out. But the sprouting process activates some enzymes, which you steep your grains and you crush them up first and then steep them like a tea, basically.
Right.
And it activates an enzyme, alpha amylase, which breaks down the sugars, breaks down the starches into simple sugars, which the yeast can then convert into alcohol.
Right.
And there's quite a lot around that different temperatures will break down, will convert slightly different sugars into slightly different lengths and
Right, right. So that's where the art comes into it, is tailoring all your...
You call it art, science. I mean, it's knowing... The art's knowing what flavour you want. The science is knowing how to get that flavour.
Okay, right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned bittering.
Yeah.
So what's involved in that?
So the hops have a chemical called... it's called the alpha acid in the hop, and that is an indication of the bittering potential of the hop. And the longer you boil them for... When you boil hops... The alpha acids get, isomerized.
Right.
And that the isomerized alpha acids are intensely bitter. And the longer you boil it for, so if you boil it for 60 minutes, you'll get a lot of the alpha acids will be isomerized. And there's also an inclusion here is different hops have different concentrations of alpha acids. So certain hops will be really high concentration, up to 20%.
Right, right. And so being acids then, that's going to shift the pH and change your flavour?
Oh, you're not adding that much.
Not that much.
Your grain has a much bigger influence on your pH.
Right, right.
It's,
okay.
You know, you're talking in 20 litres of a 20-litre homebrew, you may be adding 100 grams of hops.
So okay.
Percentage-wise is a pathetic, whereas in the grain you're talking maybe 6 kgs. So
that's the vast majority
of your ingredient is your grain.
Okay, interesting. So that's the malt and the hops.
Well, before you said that you can also add hops at a later stage, is that what I've seen when beers are advertised or on the label as dry hopped?
Yeah, so dry hopping is adding the hops either... Well, actually, dry hopping is definitely adding hops in the fermenter.
Right.
Or after fermentation's finished.
Mm-hmm.
Hops themselves are actually slightly antimicrobial, so you can actually just throw them straight into the fermenter.
And, right.
It won't affect your beer out the other end.
Right, you won't be introducing any contaminant or anything.
No,
like
and
that.
By that stage it's actually already a mildly alcoholic solution as well, so
right.
You've got
so
that
it's got its
on your side as well.
Protection.
There's not many sugars in there. You know, it's a fairly sterile environment. And you add that, and there's a lot of oils and hops that, and this is something that's probably only in the last 20 years become really a target for the hop industry and beer in general, is the hoppy IPAs, the really intense,
I love those
sort of beers. And that's still the late hops. So but when you boil your hops at the start, so you normally boil for 60 or 90 minutes in a beer, and that boils off all of those aromatic compounds. They're all volatiles, and generally most they'll get boiled off. But even if you add them, a lot of people were adding them at the end of the boil, but your wort, which is the liquid that you've extracted from the grains, is called, that will be sitting still around 90 degrees, and almost instant, the volatiles are gone. So,
right, yeah.
You know, they're very, if you can smell them in your glass at 4 degrees, you're definitely going to, they're going to disappear real quick at 90 degrees. So,
right, yeah, that's true, yeah. So there's, I think, four or at least four common sort of types of beer. Could you give us a bit of a difference between, say, an ale, a lager, a stout, IPA, porter, those types of things? Are there big differences depending on what they are?
Lager and ale. So IPA is a type of ale, and a stout is probably a type of ale as well.
Mm-hmm.
To start with, ale and lager, the difference is a type of yeast. An ale will be fermented at a slightly warmer temperature, maybe around 18 to 20 degrees, can be up to 25 for some Belgian styles,
but okay.
Generally you want to keep it below 20 because you get all sorts of funky chemicals produced by the yeast.
Right.
Lagers, on the other hand, it's a different species of yeast. It's fermented around 12 degrees, and it gives you a much cleaner flavour. There's not the aromatic compounds produced by the yeast, but it's a lot more, lagers are a lot crisper tasting would be the description. But they also, any off flavours will come through in a lager. Lagers in general are actually harder to brew.
Okay, because you're looking for that sort of cleaner
it's
taste.
Subtle,
it's
any
easier
subtle
to stuff
off flavours, just, yeah, exactly.
Right.
And then if you want to get into stouts and porters and IPAs, well, they're generally all the same. They're an ale. You just, for a stout, you've just used some dark malt in there, a stout or a porter. There's some arguments out there as actually what's the difference between a stout and a porter, and I won't go into those. I sit on the fence that I think they're not a hell of a different, to be honest.
Right.
A stout, You know, you have your grain bill. You might have 6 kgs of grain in your whole beer. You'll have maybe 500 grams at most of dark roasted, really chocolate malt, chocolatey dark.
Right, and that's what gives it that colour and the colour and the sort of toasty flavour.
Toasty flavours, exactly.
Yeah.
So the alcohol content of beer is doesn't range too much between beers like some other types of alcohol do. What's sort of responsible for that?
It's really the yeast's ability to convert sugars into alcohol.
Does at some point the alcohol content begin to just kill the yeast?
Exactly, that's part of the problem.
Right.
Yeast, alcohol is a toxin to the yeast. And
to us too, I think, yeah.
If you... The strongest beers, roughly strongest beers that are naturally fermented are around 15%.
Wow.
Which is about the same as a strong wine.
So
yeah,
is that
that's
due to
a strong red wine sort of level.
Yeah. So is that due to a special type of yeast that's able to survive?
Yeah,
or do they do rounds of fermentation or
something? It'll be a special type of yeast. You'd have to make sure your wort was really heavily oxygenated before you put the yeast in. It's just preparation. You'd have a large starter culture. Mm. So you'll grow a culture of yeast beforehand and make sure it's right in the log phase of its growth pattern, and then you'd pitch that straight into your big fermenter to produce that beer. Even then, I haven't produced a 15% beer myself, but I imagine they're tricky bloody things to produce.
Right.
They wouldn't be the simplest beer. I've done 10% beers, and they're a bit hit and miss. If you oxygenate them well, they come out really well. If you don't get it right, they taste a little bit alcohol. You can taste the alcohol in there.
Is that a sort of... Do you spend much of your time on that, trying to gauge your flavour and playing with the mouthfeel and things like that? Or do you have a recipe that you're happy with at the moment and you kind of stick with it?
Oh, I try and brew lots of different things. I've got recipes that I'm happy with, but then once I'm happy with them, I'll go off to something else that I'll try and brew something else. I've got, I've tried all sorts of Belgian styles, IPAs, pale ales, stouts, saisons. There's an entire, dictionary with beer styles, really.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So how about the water? Like, how important is the water that you use?
The water itself is really important, but it doesn't... It make the big differences around, calcium, chloride, so hard water versus soft water. And certain parts of the world, so Czech Republic, where Pilsners are famous, is incredibly soft water.
Okay.
And it is perfect water for brewing a Pilsner, whereas London and Dublin, where the dark sort of beers that originated, it's complete opposite. It's incredibly hard water, full of calcium, and that produces a sort of harsh flavour. So if you brewed a lager there without modifying your water, you would get a very harsh beer.
Okay.
Auckland water, for instance, is quite similar to not Czech Republic. It's not as soft as Czech Republic water, but it's quite soft. It's not hard. It's just sort of middle of the road water. And
do you have to worry about the light chlorination in water?
That's the only thing I muck around with. And to get rid of that, I will just fill my pot up. This is a homebrew scale. I will fill my pot up with water the night before I brew, leave it sitting there. By the morning, all the chlorine or most of the chlorine will have evaporated.
Just evaporates off,
And you can get rid of it that way. Mm. At a commercial scale, you use filters, use carbon filters and whatnot.
Right.
But that's,
that's just for throughput, for commercial scale.
So with you've played with your homebrew styles and things that you like, and now you've got a commercial setup at the moment.
Yep.
So is it the same equipment just scaled up, or is it a different... So what's your equipment setup like?
It's really quite similar to a scale-up in my homebrew system.
Right.
There's differences. The heating is elements directly in the pots, and my homebrew system is fired from the bottom, but that's neither here nor there. The fermenters are big stainless conical fermenters. They have a cone-shaped base, which is the biggest difference. My homebrew system is plastic fermenters, and so the commercial ones give us the ability to drop the yeast. With a conical shape, you can open a big tap at the bottom and just drop the yeast and all the hop debris that are sitting at the bottom out, and then condition your beer in the fermenter if you wish. Mm. So
conditioning, what's involved with that?
That's carbonation, or leaving it for a couple of, you know, a few days. Just so you cold crash it. Well, that's generally you do that before you drop the yeast out anyway. But you can chill the beer down to 2-3 degrees, and all the yeast and all the yeast will drop out of suspension. So,
is that clarifying?
It's clarifying the beer. Yeah.
Right.
You can also filter and a bunch of other things, and most breweries do. But
so once you've got to the end stage and you're looking at the bottling stage, do you run into any issues with exposure to light or exposure to oxygen or anything like that?
So exposure to oxygen and light are probably the two biggest enemies of beer. Light is a big enemy of hoppy beers.
Right,
not
right.
Such a big deal on a stout. You know, they're black. Because
some companies, you know, they have the see-through bottles. So
yeah, clear bottles generally aren't ideal. Even green bottles are not ideal. If it comes in a green bottle, it's probably ain't got bugger all hops in it.
Right. So the brown glass or the dark glass bottles are ideal
or
for
cans,
that.
Right? Cans is a new thing. Actually. And cans, but just don't drink it out of the can. Pour it into another glass.
Yeah.
The acids in your mouth or the, you know, in your saliva will dissolve a tiny bit of the aluminium around the mouth.
And that'll change the flavour.
Pour it into a glass and drink it out of the glass. Tastes exactly like it should.
Yeah, because I noticed I think it's the Sawmill Brewery do cans.
Sawmill's doing it.
I see them in the supermarket.
Deep Creek doing cans.
It also helps them stand out a bit, I think.
Cans are also more environmentally friendly. Purely, they weigh a lot less. If you're shipping them overseas, you lot less carbon.
Less oil to power those ships.
They're easier to recycle.
Right. I just had some cans just recently. And I think the beer tasted better out of it, although I'd never really considered it before. But knowing that we were coming up to speak about beer, I sort of thought about it a bit.
They do. They're also better if you're walking somewhere because they're lighter.
They're lighter. And you can crush them down. You can crush a can down to nothing, basically. And, you know, you can, if you're going hiking, you can pack it back out.
Yeah.
So just moving on to sort of more New Zealand and Mithika type discussion.
Yep.
So in New Zealand, maybe 15 years ago, I can remember when I was a child, there was only 5 or 6 beer options. You know, you had your sort of DB and your Lion Red or things like that. So, and now there's just so many options everywhere. What do you think caused this change, or how?
I think there was a few, what do you call them, groundbreakers in the industry. And even you could argue Max and Monteith's are in part of that. But the real ones, the ones I'd consider would be your Tuataras, your Emerson's, probably Epic. Epic in New Zealand, may not started, but they certainly the ones that have pushed the hoppy IPAs.
Yeah, that's true.
But in saying that, we're following the US. We're about 5 years behind the US, maybe not that anymore, but, you know, the US has been doing hoppy beers for 5-10 years longer than we have. And
Just to jump back, that brings up another question I wanted to ask. Is the difference between an APA and an IPA really just the hops?
The difference between an APA depends who you talk to. APA is generally a pale ale with American hops.
Right, okay.
An IPA will generally be a stronger beer.
Yeah, they do often look a bit darker in colour, the IPA versus the
IPA. Will be a stronger beer. So being a stronger beer, they probably added a few more specialty malts. These are malts that are slightly darker or have a slightly different, just because it brings out a bit more balance to the beer. If you just did a really light malt and a really strong beer, you'd kind of get overwhelmed by the alcohol and the hops. Although it's been done. I've done a nice 7% beer with single malt, single hop. But, yeah, it's
So with your company, how did you get it started, and what range do you have and things so far?
So, yeah, we launched early December. Got a range. Currently have a range of 2 beers, although planning to expand.
So what are those 2?
2 beers are the Incubus and the Succubus. One's an IPA, the one's a red IPA. They were sort of the names inspired by mythical creatures. Incubus being a male demon that I have to read off the bottle. male demon that seduces females, and the Succubus being the opposite of female demon that seduces males.
Right.
Which, made it. Our labels are a little bit interesting.
So where can we find them? Do you have a few places?
So if you look on mythicabrewing.com, there'll be a list of stockists.
Yep.
Liquorland Newmarket, Liquorland Mount Eden, that'd be the ones off the top of my head. Liquorland, there's another Liquorland North Shore, Forest Hill, that has a good supply. But there's a something like 50 stores or 40 stores around the country have got them. There's some in Palmy, some in Wellington.
Nice, because I have come across them before, and your labelling really stands out on the shelf. So how did you come up with that? Was that some design of yours? Or so
my business partner came up with these designs,
right.
And then he's contracted a freelance artist to actually do the artwork and do our artwork for us. And then the idea was to use shrink sleeving on the bottles, just to give us a bit more presence in the supermarket. It's the whole bottle is wrapped in the labels and just gives us more visually they stand out on the shelves.
Yeah, definitely.
And with the current market, there's a lot of competition out there, so you got to do what you can do.
Stand out where you can.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very cool. So it must be sort of difficult, like you say, there's a lot of competition out there, so you have to sort of differentiate yourself using things like that. So what do you think the most popular beer in New Zealand would be at the moment? Is it sort of like a Spates or a Steinlager or a...
Oh, they are probably the biggest sellers. One of those beers is probably Steinlager or Spates. But most popular craft beer was Panhead. One of the Panhead beers, Supercharger, was voted the best beer. Personally, I'm a big fan of Liberty's Brewing beers. They always taste good. My own beers taste good.
I've
got to say that.
You're talking about that. Now that you have an appreciation for beer, you obviously make great beer. Do you still now and again drink mass-produced beer?
Yeah.
I'll
drink a Tui if that's all it's going. But they're still good beers. Generally speaking, they're good. They are two style. The fact that they can produce that beer spot on, one after the other.
The consistency of it is
really impressive. I'll drink it, but I prefer something with a lot more hops or a lot more flavour. They are boring beers to me. I'll drink them if it's all that's going.
I think that must be what contributes to... I just looked up the per capita stats of beer consumption in New Zealand, and I think it's 65 litres... per person, so I guess it's those type of beers that are the volume.
Yeah, well, from what I understand, the craft industry is growing at about 5% per annum. It's growing a lot, and the mainstream beers are shrinking at a similar rate.
Right, okay, so there's a definite shift happening.
There's a massive shift. It's like the wine was probably in the 80s, wine became popular. I think we're going to move in that direction, and there'll be a lot more beer.
Well, just judging from the supermarket, right, I see probably more than 20 different craft beers on the shelf.
Yeah.
At least. Perhaps double that some days.
Yeah. It is quite amazing. How do you think New Zealand does on the world stage? Because I know a lot of these companies, enter in brewing competitions and things like that.
Yeah. They're doing well, from what I understand. I haven't been following it that closely, how the people are doing in competitions, but I believe some of the breweries have won a few gold medals. But even saying that, so does Steinlager, won a few gold medals. So, the competitions, it depends what you enter, I think. They're a little bit targeted.
Awesome. So we're getting close to time. If you had one more question, Ben, we could fit it in.
From me.
You're good? All right. Well, thank you very much, Kerry, for joining us today. It was interesting to learn about all the stuff that's going on.
Yeah.
And the science behind the beer, and to hear about Mythica. Yep. It's good luck with it and everything. I look forward to buying some over the weekend, I'm planning. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will be back next week live for another Street Science. Have a great week. And I'll just put some music on to play us out if I can find the right buttons here. Just give me one moment.
Nice one. Thanks, Kerry, for joining us.
Yeah, cheers.
And thanks, Blue, for having me consistently back.